Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and we're turning our attention now to adult ADHD this hour and what proper diagnosis and treatment entails with our guest, Dr. Jake Behrens. He is a psychiatrist who specializes in evaluating and treating adult ADHD. Dr. Behrens is the CEO and medical director of Envision ADHD Clinic in Mequon, Wisconsin. It opened it in 2016, I believe. As we talk with Dr. Jake Behrens, I hope you'll join in. What do you wonder about adult ADHD? Let us know how you or maybe a loved one have been affected by ADHD. Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Dr. Jake Behrens, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Lovely. Thanks for having me here.
Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder, we commonly call it ADHD. How would you define it?
Yeah, I always take notion with the name itself, where I always find it sounds way too simplistic. Yeah. Sounds like we'll just sit still and pay attention. You know, it's more than that. And also, what the heck do attention and hyperactivity even have to do with one another? Never made a lot of sense. And then the whole idea of just attention deficit. It sounds like, well, it's broken. You can never pay attention, ever. And hence, if people ever can, then it sounds like it would negate it. We know that's not true. I tend to draw a lot of things out when I'm describing them. I mean, with patients, I bring up whiteboards. But I always think of it as like much more of a more extreme variability of what I refer to as more executive function. The brain's kind of ability to put the brakes on everything else coming out of the back of it. Thoughts, movements, emotions, memories, impulses. Can we put the brakes on the engine there so we can attend to the most prioritized, the most important things at any given moment? And that's why I always look at it. It's more of a variable executive function. People can get very stimulated and do very well, higher times of executive function. And we're all going to be on a spectrum of how stimulated or not stimulated we are. But we're all going to have a baseline, basically. At some point, you know, enough that we can white knuckle, we can push through, we can use to-do list planners, we can follow those things. But when I look at ADHD, it's not that you can't get stimulated and do just well and thrive in certain scenarios, but it's like your baseline, for whatever reason, that floor drops out. And when we're sub-threshold, that's where we really struggle. I often find it's those unstimulated times. It's the dotting I's, crossing T's parts of life. Why is it that we do so well under pressure and last minute of things that get us our attention, but we struggle with the simple parts of day-to-day life? And to me, it's that difference at the bottom where we really see it.
And you created a clinic to address this ADHD in adults exclusively. What's the need for your type of clinic?
Well, it came out, I was then in Madison there, just most of my adult life, going back to undergrad all the way through med school residency, stayed on as faculty, a fantastic place. Actually, it was in one of your radio classes. I think it was sophomore year. So I remember that, splicing things together, making radio ads way back. But it was actually in residency where I really started getting in, liking ADHD in adults, which wasn't really looked at as much. You had training in child, but it wasn't really looked at in adulthood. People thought like it just magically disappears. And it was a more kind of stigmatized, biased area where we put a lot of our own thoughts like, well, if I didn't need help, why do others? But I actually really got into it when I was building out some outcome tracking scales where I was tracking rating scales with people, correlating the treatments and seeing are things getting better or not. And I was using that with a lot of patients. And it was actually a lot of my treated a lot of people that worked at Epic. Very bright people coming out of college or moving into Madison from places and getting into a place where we really need a lot of organization or seeing struggles come out. And they like taking my electronic surveys and looking at their data and tracking it. And it was an area where I really saw a lot of, oh my gosh, some of these treatments really work. You see not just ADHD symptoms, but you see anxiety and depression things. If correlated start to improve. And it was very kind of rewarding for me. And as a patient population, I identified with a lot. That's what got me into it. But I also realized it was an area that a lot of other clinicians didn't like kind of dealing with. You know, a lot of the treatments have a lot of other stigma around them. Logistically, they're very difficult to work with. The evaluations and assessments can be a lot more complicated. So I always understand as a regular practitioner, if someone comes into your schedule and you don't know anything about them and you ask them, so what brings you in today? And you have an hour and they say anything around focus or ADHD, it's almost like a slap in the forehead. Like, how am I going to get through all of this in an hour? So I understand why it's more complicated. But what really got me into it is starting to see, this is back in 2015, working with a lot of very high functioning adults and, you know, having to take the time, they had to leave work during business hours to drive downtown to see me. A lot of these are consultants. They're only in town one day a week. Very difficult to take off that day, to pick up prescriptions on paper or to come in to see me for, it was more for billing than it was medical appointments. And I started to see I couldn't do a lot of more thorough evaluations, testing, gathering data ahead of time. And what I was literally when vision came from is, could I build something that better fit this high functioning adult population, get more thorough evaluations, starting to adapt, getting early into telemedicine, electronic prescribing of controlled substances at the time, trying to get remote blood pressure monitoring, a lot of those tools. And that's what led to Envision, and literally, how would I envision getting care of myself? I wanted a robust patient portal, online scheduling, all of those things. And this was back in, I guess 2015 is when the envisioning process began.
Yeah, it's a pretty cool process the way I see it, because you do face-to-face for an initial appointment, which mm-hmm. is a fairly lengthy one, but then the rest of it, you can kind of do it at home or wherever you're working. You don't have to, and what I kind of like the idea too is you don't have to go in and sit in a waiting room.
Yeah.
I was with somebody else once who was going in to see a person and a specialist, and they were a little reluctant, and then what do they see in the waiting room but another person who they know very well, who they didn't know was going to be in there, and it was kind of uncomfortable, let's say.
Okay. I say I've always maintained what I call a hybrid practice. I do meet every person in person at least the first time, and that's part of a regulatory thing, but it's also a time for me to meet, ensure they can always drive to me if they ever need to, and I also bundle in and give them a blood pressure cuff to go home with. But what I've always found in there is my whole goal is I want people to be more productive, more in control in the driver's seat of their life. And I always find, okay, what is needed to do that? And anything else that pulls them away from that, like, I want you to be more productive. I don't want this, us trying to help you to be, pulling you away from your home, your life, your work, your relationships, and all of that. So, and I was wondering, so just a lot of fine tuning. I like the treatment because I'm very impatient. So I like the careful, like the fine tuning of treatment so that you can really get pretty hands on. And I always say, I want to be available when my patients need me, not just arbitrary meet me every 3 months or once a month or whatever, but I want to be available when you need me. Let's make changes right there in the moment. And then we'll follow up when it best fits your schedule. And that's what I always wanted it to be. I also knew myself going way back is even getting like a haircut. I'm sorry, if I can't walk in or schedule it online, I'm probably not going to do it. So that was a tenet of myself way back is like, I need direct scheduling, immediate availability, because that's what I would want for myself. And that's Envision HD basically came, what kind of service would I want to be able to get connected with healthcare?
Brett in Eau Claire has a question, I believe, or comment. Let's go there. Brett, hello. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, thank you. I'm 63 years old. I only recently got an ADHD diagnosis, although everything kind of clicked. And I had actually gone into the VA and wanted to talk about ADHD because I'm a veteran, and that was about 2015. And it's kind of funny how much the criteria for ADHD seems to have changed over the years, because when I was in grade school, there was no ADHD. It was back in the early 70s and 60s and 70s. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering how does that fit into, you know, your experience as far as older adults, especially people in my age group, which would be much older adults?
Yeah. Well, certainly, you know, this has been an ongoing kind of like evolution, even from criteria and whatnot. And I would say, just because it seems that we're talking about numbers going up or something doesn't mean that magically this is popping up out of the blue. It just means, what do we do to kind of to diagnose? How do we look at it? It's going to be a selection bias. You know, technically we have looking at things well before ADHD was ever a term. Even go back into the 30s, we're looking at hyperactive children in halfway houses somehow magically being able to calm down when they were given an older class of stimulant to help with headaches. But what I was finding here is, you know, I guess different eras, so to speak, is what do we look at? What are we looking for? You know, obviously, even just the ability of what happened in classrooms, what were teachers evaluating, what were expectations of children, expectations of kids, basically, even from parents, what was parenting and teaching styles like were probably very different. Same is true, you know, recognizing of anxiety or depression. Rates have changed just the more that we, you know, kind of look for it. Now, it used to be that ADHD was this thing that was only apparent in children. Magically, it disappeared at age 18, like nothing else in the human body does. But it was, and even where we still had this stigma, I think everyone's idea of ADHD is, even the way it's even, I still remember even being taught in med school and in residencies, they show videos of like a hyperactive 8-year-old boy, like bouncing around the classroom or like dragging his parents around on the street. I still remember it. And that's what we think of as very, what I call externalized symptoms. That child that is literally driving their parents and teachers batty because they're all over the place. And that's what would lead to getting help. That's what we looked at it as. Whereas in reality, we have to realize that's what's shown on the outside. But what's shown on the inside, more like say the internalized symptoms, are far more apparent. The inattention, the impulsivity, even like what I'd say more the inner restlessness, be it the tapping of the foot, just always having to be doing something, but it's not bothering people on the outside. It's not calling attention to yourself or be like, oh my gosh, like here's young Johnny, he needs help here. And that's what's been evolving over the years. And even in here, it's even with depression, anxiety symptoms, it's not that like we're all on a spectrum. We all have aspects of those. And really it's anything that's a catch. It's only a problem if it's a problem for the individual. I think we're just starting to look at that more. What is going on? Is it getting in the way of parts of life? And what I think we're really starting to understand too is what are the, not just the risks of treatment, but what are the risks of not treating? And that's actually where we have a lot of data from large kind of population-based studies to see what are the higher risks if we don't get in and treat it. But as you're going forward, you know, it's, I was just looking at some data in here of, you know, it's like still over half the people currently diagnosed in a 2004 study, I believe, 50% were diagnosed in their adulthood.
Wow. And I think a lot of folks have, I've read somewhere where a lot of people recognize that they were having trouble or had it because their child was being diagnosed with it.
Yeah. That's what I remember still being at UW. That was the most common thing I would see is now professors, physicians, lawyers, and a lot of times it was going in with their kids, came up to their kids, their teachers brought it up. They went, they learned about it. Like, oh my gosh, they read an example. Like, wait, this has been me my entire life. And that's what lead to going to look at it. Cause it's also known to be one of the more heritable, like carried down in generations of conditions within psychiatry.
Yeah, we have some questions or some emails relating to just that coming up. Brett and Eau Claire, thank you so much for calling. Our guest today, Dr. Jake Behrens, psychiatrist. He is the CEO and medical director of Envision ADHD Clinic in Mequon, Wisconsin. Join in with your questions at 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. You can get trustworthy reporting and unique local stories delivered directly to your inbox by subscribing to WPR's daily newsletter. It's curated by WPR's Jenny Peake. And you'll never miss the day's top stories, the must-listen-to audio segments, exclusive feature photos, and behind-the-scenes conversations with reporters. Just stop at WPR.org/newsletters and go there, and you'll stay informed and connected. We're staying connected right now with Dr. Jake Behrens, who is a psychiatrist and CEO of medical director of Envision ADHD Clinic, Envision ADHD Clinic in Mequon, Wisconsin, as we talk with him about ADHD. And again, you can join in. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. Louise emailed us, can you talk about the components of executive functioning and how that forms a diagnosis? Many people still think there's a difference between ADD and ADHD. Not sure how things have changed.
For sure. And I would say often when I'm going through this, I'm very visual. So I'll often be bringing up like a whiteboard and drawing out what's going on in the brain and all the connections. So I apologize. It doesn't always translate as well. But I always think of the brain as this engine, this high horsepower, highly evolved engine that different areas, and they pump things out. I don't care. Thoughts, movements, emotions, memories, impulses, all areas are firing. That's what it's supposed to do. That's the gift that we have. And when I think of executive function, I'm often thinking of that as more the prefrontal cortex, back behind the forehead, which is also the last part of the brain to develop in childhood. Is the brain generally develops from the back to the front. And I think of that area as like all of those, you know, thoughts, movements, emotions, memories, impulses, they're all going to have to kind of subconsciously get filtered through the prefrontal cortex. And that's where I think of executive function. And that's going to have to basically prioritize, rank, order all of those, let's just say the top 20 things a second that come out of it. And then it's going to have to make that executive decision to be like, all right, you know, maybe we can deal with, let's just say, the top three most important of those things at any given moment. But then it has to be able to put the brakes on all those other centers, put the brakes on some of the movements, put the brakes on some of the extraneous thoughts. But another thing that's not always talked about as part of ADHD, and I think we'll see this more in terms of the diagnostic criteria in the future, but it's also putting the brakes more on the emotional centers as well. Where it's not that we don't have thoughts or we shouldn't have emotions, but sometimes we need to kind of slow down different parts so we can deal with other things and then come back to it. So when I think of executive function, it's the ability to organize and prioritize everything coming out of your engine, and then ultimately being able to put the brakes on or inhibit some of the more extraneous things so that you can keep your mind and body focused on the higher prioritized items. And that's where I think of what's going on and how active or not active, how stimulated or not stimulated is that part of the brain at different times. And that's what I'm also finding. As kids, while we're waiting for that part of the brain to develop, we naturally have a lot of those things externally being done for us. You know, when we're young, our parents literally tell us what to eat, what to wear. Every second of the day is planned. When do you go to bed? When do you wake up? And then, you know, a little bit more development. You go to school. You're in elementary school. You have one class, one teacher. Everything is still laid out for you. You go to middle school. You get a little bit more autonomy as we age. Go to high school a little bit more. Then we get into early adulthood. That's when we go to college for the first time. And I would say to me, it's more the rule, not the exception, that a lot of times that's where it's like you take the training wheels off. It's like goodbye, all that external support. You're left to your own devices. Not to mention higher academic rigor. You know, for so long as you're not bothering people or failing miserably, IQ alone, you can probably sit down and pass a test, especially with the external support to help, you know, stay on top of you, accountability. And I always think, to me, it's the rule, not the exception, that when people leave home for the first time, take off the training wheels, that it's kind of the rule, not the exception. And a lot of times that's when the wheels kind of fall off, so to speak. And a lot of stuff starts showing itself. But when it comes to kind of the ADD, ADHD, it used to be kind of attention deficit disorder or ADHD, just having a hyperactive component. Even then, it never made a lick of difference which one you called it. The treatments were all exactly the same, just as efficacious. Because in the end, we're still trying to treat executive function. It's just, I look at that as just how externalized versus internalized are the symptoms. The more externalized, the more bouncing off the walls, got the ADHD aspect. But it doesn't mean the same thing's not on the inside. Now, from the just DSM-5, they changed the naming of it, which is all falls under ADHD, and then it's
just delineated to predominantly inattentive type or predominantly hyperactive impulsive type or combined type, just different nomenclature for the similar conditions. But in the end, it's never really affected how we treat it. It's just, to me, it's how internalized or externalized are the symptoms.
You were talking about the going into college. I had a student once, and this is a long time ago, and I wondered about him at the time, and I just wasn't knowledgeable enough in this area. But we, you know, there was an assignment every week that had to be done, and one assignment built on the next assignment, and he could never get the assignment in on time.
Mm-hmm.
He's physically, I mean, I sat down and had quite a long talk with him. He just physically couldn't do it. He could get it in late, and it would be pretty darn good.
Yeah.
But he couldn't meet the deadline. And I assume that may be a potential trait of somebody with ADHD.
From what I find in there, it's almost like it becomes a learned behavior. As we think, what are the things that do get us activated? We think of what gets kind of some of the dopamine pathways, and it's tied in with the pleasure reward system. But three things I would say that get us kind of activated there, that get us stimulated, be physical activity, movement, exercise, pleasure, novelty, sex, drugs, rock and roll, the classes we enjoy, the books we like, the video games that get us stimulated, or some amount of optimal stress pressure deadline, the cortisol adrenal response, in short, bouts, get that stimulated. So something I find is, with, like, especially untreated ADHD, it's almost people learn to live life always having to be physical motion, bouncing around, bouncing their leg, pacing, doing something to focus, only doing things they enjoy and avoiding everything else. Or almost like, and this is where we see so much of this stress, anxiety, which I think gets overlapped with it, because they learn to live life always having to be in a even artificially created, but in a place of stress, pressure, deadline, just to function. It's almost like people like, that person you're speaking of probably like sit at his desk or whatever. I have a week to do this. I'm going to work on this diligently. I'm going to be this good, you know, worker, student. But it's probably like pipe dream. The mind's in a thousand places, legs bouncing, just worthless. But then as the pressure deadline builds, maybe gets a little bit better, a little bit more stimulation. But so many times it's not until that final moment when there's enough, you cross that threshold, enough stress, pressure, deadline, then finally you can sit still. The mind goes to what's in front of it because it's putting the brakes on everything else. And then like paragraphs start the flow, the work starts to go. But it's like living life always having to be on that very tight precipice of enough stress to be functional, but not so much stress that it gets in the way or enough that you run out of time and you fail miserably. It's a very low margin for error place to try and exist. And that's where I find there's so much stress that can be associated with untreated ADHD.
Yeah. Carolyn in Janesville has a comment. Let's go there. Carolyn, hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Wow, you guys are hitting it on the head. I also was diagnosed by my child's doctor. He told me I definitely had it too, and I was in the perfect career, being that I was a florist, that I could bounce from one thing to another and not have to make the same thing over and over again. And then just like what you're talking about right now, oh my God, packing for a trip, there's no way I could start a week ahead of time. I mean, mm-hmm. The pressure of it being, I have to leave in 4 hours, that is the only way my brain can organize packing for a trip. Otherwise, I'm so anxious, I can't.
Yeah. And it's like magically all of a sudden in that 0 hour, things just come together, like the static kind of dissolves, and like just it's almost like magic how it happens.
Right. I just you guys are really enlightening to me, you know, even at my age, my late 60s, like this is what's been wrong with me. This is why it's hard for me to read a book. I can't concentrate. It's hard for me to do any kind of math. I can't concentrate, and concentrating makes me anxious.
Yeah.
I say it's not just sit still and pay attention. It's, you know, once again, it's something, executive function affects all parts of life. It's how we make plans with friends. It's what happens when we're driving a car. It's following a diet or following an exercise plan, even being present and doing the work in therapy. All of that stems from that initial executive function.
Yeah. Carolyn, thank you very much for calling. Heather in New Holstein emailed us. They have an undiagnosed ADHD adult daughter who is married and has children, one with severe ADHD and one with significant autism, as well as she also has a stepdaughter with significant mental health needs. What advice do you have for someone like her to organize her life to make all the appointments and other demands on her a little easier if she doesn't have time or money to get diagnosed and treated herself? Wow.
Yeah. I was going to say, it's dealing with anything in the healthcare space, there's no question. It's often more complicated than often needs be. One of the, depending on where people are, I always recommend start with primary care. They're going to know your situation. Someone that knows you, what potentially in-network resources might they have? Are they comfortable working with this themselves or referring out? Obviously, we have different ways of kind of evaluation on the psychiatry space. Generally, on the psychiatry space or in primary care, where a lot of times the diagnosis will be, I could get into a lot of ways that I prefer doing evaluations and everything that goes into it. But I think for right now, it's just finding resources where you are. And I would certainly say primary care. I'll get some resources to the show. I don't know if there's show notes or anything, but yeah. One place I like, just a lot of information, great for families, for individuals, for adults, for kids, a lot of actionable, but the editorial board, I think, does a nice job of laying it out and make sure it's more evidence-based things. But one site I would draw you to would be attitudemag.com. Some actionable articles, everything from diagnosis to treatment to articles on very actionable, but like stepwise type of things for productivity, organization, and whatnot. That's one place I often will draw kind of patients to as a starting place.
And where is it again?
In our healthcare system, especially from an insurance side, it does not make getting connected easily, especially on the side of things here.
Yeah. And it's Attitude. What is it again? Attitude.
AttitudeMag.com.
Okay. We'll put that up on our, Clara will put that up on our site on today's date in our program notes.
I'll have a lot of resources, even general things on some myths on those websites, even some other things. I always think interesting things on medications. I'll get a number of resources over if any of them are helpful.
Yeah, send them over to Clara. You've been emailing with her. Send them to her, and she can post those in our program notes later, and then hopefully later in the day, so people can get to those. That's great. Greg in Madison, your turn. Hi, Greg.
Hello. Hi. Thanks for having me. My question was about the kind of correlation between OCD, ADHD, and autism. I'm a special ed teacher in Madison, and I see the sort of, I'm sure you do too. Do you think someday that they'll all be on the spectrum of autism or neurodiversity, or does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm with you. I think a lot of the conditions we have in psychiatry, in the end, we're in a, in many ways, there's more overlap. Then there are kind of like, depression is this one thing, anxiety is this one thing, OCD is this one thing. So I think, yes, there is going to be a lot of overlap in what is kind of causing what. And even as I always think of laying things, this is what I always think it's very important from an evaluation, and especially with ADHD, where we know it's the rule, not the exception. There's likely to be what we call comorbidities. Like, I'm not saying they're all individual separate diagnoses, but you're likely to have a more confounded picture because every part of life is going to be affected and you'll see symptoms that have a lot of overlap. I always look at things from that aspect as, when trying to tease it out, I find it helpful to do like individual rating scales, show them next to each other, which areas then are showing the highest level of magnitude, highest scores, so to speak, within the rating scale compared to each other. That combined with what are the main concerns of the individual, of the patient in that case? What are the areas that are really getting in life of the way most, potentially using that as a starting place? Or in the end, say of some of the conditions there, which areas have some of the most kind of like evidence-based treatments in a way? So in the case of there, once again, OCD is its own very real thing. Are it specifically OCD symptoms that are getting in the way of life, or does it seem to be some of the other ones? Or if, you know, autism and ADHD, I know there's been a lot of kind of chatter in both those areas. I would say I am less familiar on the autism side. And even that's always been known as we call a spectrum disorder, as, you know, where on the range of it. And that's what I think we should look at most conditions. You know, calling it a disorder, I always, okay, what does that really mean? But I always look at it there as, okay, if someone will tell me, hey, I want to look at autism, like, okay, we could, even if diagnosed, the question is, what do you do about it? I care more about treatment action, what can we do to help, than I do about nomenclature and that in my head, like, nay, what do we call it only matters so much in terms of it affects what we do about it in my book. And I always look, when it comes to autism, there's going to be less, we'll be treating individual symptoms, at least from the medical standpoint. And that's where I'm still trying to, if it's mainly the OCD symptoms getting in the way or mainly the ADHD symptoms, that might target where I would go to first while still keeping a global eye on the broader picture of all symptoms. I realize that's getting way far more technical. I'm in my own head picturing everything the data I bring up and share with patients as we look at it together. But I'm with you, you're more likely to have overlap of many of these areas than to not.
Greg, thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. Dennis in Menominee, we go to you. Hi, Dennis.
Hello. Thank you.
Yeah, what's on your mind?
Well, a couple things. Going back to the lady who has two children with special needs and concerns, of course, for herself, for resources, every county, and it should be noted, that every county has an aging and disability resource center, which is a resource for that lady if she is not already involved with them, to look at what resources are available to her and to her children. I happen to be an individual who received my diagnosis or an explanation of why I am as I am, shall we say, at age 83, which is current. And for all the years that I've noted issues myself, concerns, never had a physician look a little closer as to what may be an explanation of why I had limitations myself.
Yeah. Dennis, that's thank you very much. I'm glad you found out where you are now, but it took 83 years.
Yes. But it was, shall we say, a bit of a handicap, but it's not stopped me from being, I think, successful in many respects.
Mm-hmm. Jake, a comment, Dr. Jake Behrens, what do you think?
Yeah, I always look at that. You know, ADHD does not mean failure by any means. And I always say in there is it's, you know, you can thrive in so many places, and people always know, you know what you're capable of doing. And that's what makes it so difficult when there's that discrepancy between what you know you're capable of doing, but where you struggle at the different times. If this is truly like a pure deficit of attention, it'd be like ignorance is bliss, you'd be none the wiser about it. And that wouldn't be as stressful, but that discrepancy leads to so much stress. And I think of what you've noticed in here. And I would say even with a lot of people diagnosed later in life, it's not an uncommon thing I find is that initial time, like, oh my gosh, I'm just figuring this out now. And it's almost some of this idea of like, well, where would things be if I'd been, I don't know, sooner, or some of this, it's almost like it's going through more of a therapy type of approach, getting people to kind of into that acceptance phase of, hey, where are we now? And what are the opportunities now going forward? And that's not an uncommon kind of aspect, but it's also, you know, as we have awareness of this, anytime you go to see a doctor, you're generally, you know, it's even the first thing on the list, we call it chief complaint. What's the patient's main concern right now? And unless it's something that's brought up to a given clinician, they're like, we're generally not just trained to just look for everything and start the trend from. We deal with what is brought up in front of us. And I'm on there. I was just curious, like, what was that initially kind of led to looking further into this for yourself, or what brought this to your doctor's attention?
Well, we lost him. We didn't lose him. It's interesting. Well, maybe he was able to articulate it better. Maybe he had a doctor that was more familiar with this kind of treatment. There's probably could be any number of reasons why it was finally presented to him. And I'm now that he was obviously a guy. Is gender, is it more prevalent among males than females?
Yeah, we have to realize anytime we have prevalence data, it's going to be like a one point in time analysis. So it's always going to be fluctuating. Of more recent data, it's the most recent one that I've found in there, like 44% in women, 55% in males. And that's after it used to be much more skewed male to female. But I think so much of that comes down to, once again, the internalization, externalization of symptoms, where yes, in young boys, more likely to have the externalized, the bouncing off the walls, the hyperactivity. So more likely to be basically, the more likely you are to bother someone, i.e. a teacher or a parent, the more likely you're probably to get looking to get help and potentially diagnosed and treated. What I find with so many times with women is the symptoms are more internalized, of more of, you know, it's not shown on the outside as much. Doesn't mean the same restlessness, the same inattentiveness, the same mind wandering is there, but it's not bothering people. So they're not calling attention to themselves. So yes, I think a major kind of underdiagnosed population often been in girls and in women. And when we see kind of quote unquote prevalence is rising, or people say, oh my gosh, the number of diagnoses has skyrocketed, like during the pandemic and what people have learned about it. And yes, and there's something to be said, is we need to keep an eye on what is actually a diagnosis, not just a lot of self-diagnosis. But something I always have to look at that is, even before the pandemic, let's just say, you know, rates have been like, estimated rates, 4 to 6% of like adult population diagnosed, which is a very large amount of people, likely to have the diagnosis. Only half of them are potentially diagnosed. But when that was the case, like, we were underdiagnosing. It was something like, it was estimated like 70% of people likely to have the condition were not diagnosed. And then in the pandemic, people getting online, a lot of these fly-by-night kind of companies coming up, people getting diagnosed, and oh my gosh, the rates are skyrocketing. They still haven't even caught up with the estimated prevalence yet. So I always like to say, we had a beach ball like held underwater, just ready the moment we start putting some eyes on this and start looking for something, that it was gonna pop up. And it hasn't shot past that. But I always wanna look at that when people make very kind of excitatory type of statements like that. Okay, what evidence are we basing that on? Where are we in the like estimate of prevalence versus likely to be diagnosed or let alone even treated? Or even now, I think it's less than 50% of people even diagnosed are treated for such conditions.
Mm. Well, let's talk a little about treatments. And medications certainly come into play. I actually have a question from a person about using Ritalin, but I'll get to that. But just more broadly, I know some medications are stimulants, and some are non-stimulants. Mm-hmm. Why is that distinction important?
Well, just in general, in treatment and things, I always draw up a big whiteboard and going with patients. I always like to kind of break everything down. This would be true of any diagnosis in psychiatry. I like the breakdown. We have, you know, medication options, therapy, or sometimes an ADHD, more coaching, kind of more accountability type of therapy, exercise, diet, diving further into different labs, or especially testing into supplement side of things. And we'll have this for just about any condition. And a lot of these, you know, we have, you know, talking an antidepressant for depression, I can't necessarily say that that's going to be more likely to be beneficial for depression than, say, therapy, than exercise, than vitamin D supplementation in some cases. ADHD is one of the few areas, and this is what one of the things drew me to it, where some of the medications have the highest effect size I kind of think of it as the likelihood that this given treatment will affect this given condition. And definitely stimulants for ADHD is one of the highest effect sizes of any medication class in the psychiatry field. So I always thought that was an odd thing, whereas if we don't know what we're going to go to diagnose, my book, like, err on the thing that we know is potentially likely to help it, or that we're good at treating. So I'm never going to say medications are the only answer, but I always want the big menu of options. I think everything can fit together. And sometimes I find, if anything, medications, if I think of a stimulant, I think, well, you have to ask yourself, I hate the term stimulant as well, because you have to ask, well, what is it stimulating? If it's stimulating basically dopamine and norepinephrine to the prefrontal cortex, stimulating executive function, stimulating the brakes, all of a sudden it starts to make a lot more sense. Like, why do stimulants help hyperactive boys? That doesn't make any intuitive sense. Yet it's a known phenomenon going back into the 30s. But I always think of that. What is it stimulating? And it makes more sense. But then as we get into the different stimulants and non-stimulants, that really comes down to, in some ways, how regulated they are, where stimulants are going to be controlled substances, logistically much more difficult to work with. They can't have refills. They have to be requested each time. You can't fill them sooner than, say, 28 days on a 30-day supply, shortages, all of that. But their effects, I draw this up, but they're going to be much more time-dependent. When they're direct acting, when they're in your system, you'll notice it from this hour to this hour, and you dose accordingly. Non-stimulants, more like antidepressants, take it, wait for that downstream indirect effect of consistently having your body waiting that often, 4 to 6 week kind of thing to see an overall benefit, they're easier to work with.
Dr. Jake Behrens, our guest, director of Envision ADHD Clinic in Mequon, Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking today with Dr. Jake Behrens, director of Envision ADHD Clinic in Mequon, Wisconsin. And we have an email that relates to what we were just talking about, Dr. Behrens. A six-year-old grandson was pretty severe ADHD and always had a very limited diet. He started Ritalin in April. It made a huge difference. He even prefers to be on it. Unfortunately, it's made him lose 5 pounds. He started at only 45 pounds to begin with. And he is back up to 41 pounds, gained a pound back after starting an appetite stimulant, but avoidant restrictive food intake disorder was also recognized or discussed recently as a diagnosis as well. Is there any med that he could try that would help the ADHD but not affect his appetite? Is there a high comorbidity between the two, and what are the options, or what might they be?
Well, obviously, like, lower appetite while during the what I call duration of effect, while a medication like a stimulant is active, can be one of the potential side effects. Often I think lower appetite and wake promotion, being more awake over those hours. And I always think, once again, I work primarily with adults, and I find it's almost like that risk benefit for the average child versus adult kind of flips in adulthood. When we're kids, we need to eat more, we need to grow and develop, but we have that amazing thing, we have tons of energy too, and we only eat when we're hungry. Then often we flip into adulthood, and I'd say the average adult, I find, is, if anything, we wish we had more energy, we had tons of caffeine, and we eat for any number of reasons, because we're bored, because it's noon, because of any reason. If anything, we want to be in better control of our appetite and eat less. Obviously, eating disorders are real things. That's a very different side. So I always find, like, it's odd how in childhood, major concerns, obviously, with eating. We go to adulthood, and it's like, yes, please. Like, wait, that's the side effect? Okay, yes, like, whatever we can do. And also, you have some overlap with binge eating disorder and actually FDA approval for some of the stimulant medications on that side of it. In childhood, it's obviously going to be more difficult because once, the child is less likely, like, yes, I know I need to eat. I'm doing it for this reason. I will eat because I know I should, not just because I'm hungry. So it's a little bit more complicated. What I've found it in there is, even with the adults, if we have lower appetite, one of the biggest things is making sure that we have, start the day with food in the stomach, getting the calories, then trying to time food around, think about when is that medication active or less active, might tie with times where if you have food available at those times, might they be more likely to have it. Often I find having very easy grab and go with adults, you know, if you have to cook or prepare or something or clean up, you're less likely to do it. So often I find things with full macros in things, certain types of like protein bars, pre-made shakes, a little bit of sweetness. I find if it's in front of you, you're more likely to consume it. And sometimes a little bit more sweetness might be more likely to consume it as well. Now, in terms of medication that you mentioned is on the, just within the stimulant class, basically, if you think of a stimulant, you have basically two sides, you have the amphetamine side and like the Adderall side, and then the Ritalin methylphenidate side, some variations of like half the mixture, half the molecule, but basically you have two components. Everything else is packaging. How does it get released? How does it come on and off in the body? But if any concerns on one side, you know, maybe switching from that one class to the other, might notice they can both have potential for lower appetite. You know, we're talking about some appetite stimulants and some antidepressants, some other treatments might help with appetite along with it. Other things, you know, there are non-stimulants, although technically you can still have lower appetite with those as well. Again, the non-stimulants, technically, I know in the package insert, at least for fluoxetine, Qelbree, lower appetite is still something that's associated with it. Strattera and amoxetine, I'd have to review that again. But I always look at the non-stimulants if that's the case, or just finding ways that really with, I think of stimulants much more as puzzle pieces. How long are they spanning? How do you span the day accordingly with them? And can you use some of that timing to fit in specific meal times?
That's a very, very good point. What you, and you mentioned coaching or therapy, I guess you could call it, that can play a big role, can it not?
This is what I find in it. I always think of when we're trying to build, I look at medications often. Initially, everything stems from executive function. So often I look at, it's not that medications are the end-all, be-all, solve everything, but if we get that initial boost to executive function, then can we start building the rest of things? Everything that people have been telling you to do for years, you know, can I start using that to-do list, that calendar, building those habits, following an exercise plan, following a diet plan? Does those things, you know, so it's not just in one ear, out the other, does it start to build from there? And what I find with coaching, it's once again, especially like with transitions, you're, you know, moving to a new place, starting a new job, or you're having trouble getting some of those habits jump-started. Sometimes we just need that external accountability, that external pressure. Because I think inherently, we're all very good at disappointing ourselves or sometimes disappointing loved ones, but we're really bad at disappointing strangers. Thank goodness. You know, sociopathy is a different thing. But having that third-party person that we know we have to check in with. So some things, you know, and just doing it directly with an app, I don't think works as well. We need that accountability, so a human component to it. But some things people set up with, like, what's this like? Even if it's, you know, a weekly check-in and setting up, what are you going to do? How are you going to do it? Like, you know, like setting up the coming week, like a shared to-do list. That person will be following you throughout as you do it. And, you know, even in a week, you have to check in. What worked? What didn't? Let's get set up for the next week. And I would say you don't have to set this up and do it from here to eternity. And also, coaching is not going to be something that generally fits in with the insurance coverage. It'll be outside of it. So it's not you have to do this from here on. But even if you think of it like, you know, when people started using Fitbits or tracking their steps or whatnot, you're not going to do this for years. But if you do this for a few months, you start learning the habits. You start learning what works, what doesn't. Did I have a good day? Did I get my steps? And you stop looking at it, but you still know intuitively if it works. And at some point, you stop using it. You do well, you do well. Maybe you fall off the wagon, but then you don't have to go back to it for like 6 months. Maybe you go back to it for a month, get back on the wagon and go to get kind of the jumpstart. That's how I look at coaching. Can you get this in there? Just that external accountability does wonders.
And on that note, Dr. Jake Behrens, thank you so much for taking an hour to be with us today to talk about your work with ADHD and things that we can do to resolve the issues that it can create. Jake Behrens, our guest today. He is CEO and medical director of Envision ADHD Clinic in Mequon, Wisconsin. It's great to have him with us. And thanks to Joel Patna, Clara Neipert, Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Robbins on our team, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller.